Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about the state of Black America, at least as maybe the Urban League and their State of Black America report is describing it, and maybe some of the contradictions there. And we're joined for this conversation by Dr. Jared Ball, professor at Morgan State University and also the curator of imixwhatilike.org. Dr. Ball, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks again.
So let me just start with this Urban League State of Black America report. I mean, they release them every year, these reports. I think there's obviously a lot of valuable data in them on a lot of different bases. They also establish kind of their own indices and a couple of different things to sort of try to measure equality, I guess. So I'm just curious, maybe some of your top-of-the-line thoughts here. I think it looks like Black people are standing at about 72.3% of white people in equality. I don't even really know 100% what that means, but I guess that's their top line number. Are we two-thirds equal to white people in America?
Well, I think the easy answer is no, but this is where I would want to start. The first place that I went to look at the report once it was published was at their partners page, which I think is extremely important. And as you look at the State of the Black America Partners page, you see that it's partnered or sponsored by AT&T, Bank of America, the Lilly Global Healthcare Group, Toyota, Walmart, and Wells Fargo. So immediately, I would want to raise caution about, if not the numbers themselves, the conclusions we're asked to draw as a result. You know, if we look at historically, Walmart not only are they engaged in all kinds of harmful labor relations practices that depreciate labor all around the world, but they take their money and invest it in the Walton Family Foundation, which is one of the more conservative think tanks that produces a lot of the reports and studies that are encouraged to be used by elite press and politicians to shape national discussion and policy around very conservative ideas. And of course, Wells Fargo easily stands out regarding this particular report and issue because they're, of course, still trying to clean up their image after having played such a pivotal role in the subprime lending scandal that depreciated and devalued, I think it was something like 200%. Black wealth in the country was just wiped out to the extent that there could have been said to have been any. It was more or less wiped out in part because of Wells Fargo and their predatory lending. So having tried to already adjust their image with their financial literacy campaign with the NAACP, here they are again behind or supporting the kind of investigation, as we might call it, of the condition of Black America. And then I would also want to point out very quickly that Bank of America, for me personally, and my own particular pet peeve that you and I spoke about on your show last year at some point, it's the Bank of America, the Selig Group, Selig Center, positioned in Bank of America's building in Athens, Georgia, that produces a lot of the mythological numbers around Black buying power. Starting there, I mean, as I just look at it, and then when I went and looked at Marc Morial's introductory statement, the other glaring thing that sticks out to me before we even begin to look at some of the conclusions or numbers drawn from this is that he's immediately arguing that because under Obama, the Urban League was able to grade the improvement of Black America and America in general as excellent, they are now positioning this report to say we need to, as they say, protect our progress under the more aggressive and hostile Donald Trump. Now, this is not to say, obviously, that there are no differences between Trump and Obama, but what for me is a problem with that framing of this issue before, again, getting into the report itself, is that it's suggesting that there was some sort of progress gained under Obama, progress that, of course, would have to be weighed against, you know, centuries or more of hostility and horrific, you know, beginning position or false standards for the judgment of humanity that make everything look like progress. But then also it suggests that society as a whole was moving in a more progressive, positive direction, only now to be met by the horrific Donald Trump, where I think it's more important for our developing analyses to understand that Trump is a logical extension, not only of Obama's administration, but the entire national political and even cultural social will. So I was immediately struck by that, you know, that already it's being positioned as we were making progress, we were doing better, and now here comes Trump, and we have to protect the progress that we had previously made, which, as has been raised by a couple of critics already, is interesting to note in terms of the Urban League's own reports, because the report titled in 2016 was titled in 2016 as Locked Out, saying that Black America had been locked out of many of the significant or important categories that by which we measure a community's standing or progress. So I just wanted to start with that initial piece to say that I think these reports are in many ways helpful for offering up some information, but in the end, I think they're often damaging because of the way that they're framed or the conclusions that we're asked to reach, which perhaps you and I could talk a little bit about in this
sense. Move on. Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that 2016 was locked out and then now all of a sudden it was all great. I mean, it also seems like it's serving to be like revisionist history for what really happened in the Obama administration. I would say one thing that is interesting to me, you know, I thought it was a good article from December by Sandy Darity from down there in Duke about black wealth. And whatever you think about the concept, the whole thing is about how Barack Obama did not actually enact any programs that were transformatively changing the economic position of black people in America, even some that, you know, had been pushed for years by many people. And it just sort of – and how also he raises the issue of how sort of the Obama's rhetoric around sort of a rising tide lifts all boats actually sort of set back black people and sort of his internalization of so many of the sort of pathological things that are put out there about why black people don't do well had also set people back. Since he was the first black president, it gave more credence to a lot of that sort of social pathology stuff than ever. So that's a little bit of a digression, but I think it's on a random level. But I think – go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, if I could cut in, I don't think it's a digression because – and I'm not sure if we're talking about the exact same article because Professor Darity has been kind of prolific on this. But in a recent one that I just saw co-written with Derek Hamilton titled The Political Economy of Education, Financial Literacy, and the Racial Wealth Gap, they begin their assessment similar to my own critique of the way this is discussed and the way even this Urban League report has been handled and framed so far. Their first mission is to point out that often these disparities and discrepancies are described and defined as being the result of poor choices made by poor people, in this case, black and Latinos, and that the complexities and the nuances of how this system that they don't necessarily call out as capitalism, but they recognize as an institutionalized systemic problem of creating inequality has nothing to do with saving or spending habits. In fact, they note that black people, based on income and situation and you know, controlled for the important differences there, actually save more than white people do. But at the end of the day, as they conclude, black and Latinos, who make up 30% of the U.S. population, collectively only own 7% of the nation's private wealth. So that when we start to look at what the State of the Dream, or rather the Urban League report, State of Black America, is saying, the inequality described in those pages, while described, I think, on some level as being institutional, also do in some way point to the financial illiteracy of black America as being part of the problem. And in fact, one of their contributors in the Solution Circle section picks up on this theme, at least slightly, in talking about the way black families do or do not invest in their houses, in homes and saving and stuff like that, as if that is at all part of the problem. By the way, I would also want to make that point further, that a lot of the contributors that are selected to respond and offer solutions, so-called, come from the same basic liberal apparatus that I think ultimately supports or exacerbates these problems. So whether it's Cory Booker, who you know, has a long-standing, complicated relationship with advancing progressive politics, or whether it's Congressman Cedric Richmond, a member of the CBC, Congressional Black Caucus, which Black Agenda Report and others have been calling out for years as being part of the misleadership class and part of the very problems exacerbating these issues. I mean, this is the class of people being brought in to offer up responses. And, of course, you have Urban League members offering responses as well.
Right. And then you got the one token radical voice from their perspective. And I mean, I would say I think it's fair to say she's radical voice, Opal Tomate from well, identified as Baji, but also in the founders of Black Lives Matter. I'm just like, okay, so you got like five Congress people, including Terry Sewell from Alabama, former Wall Street banker, you know, a bunch of – some dude from – like some two white dudes from some like hedge fund talking about how, you know, I don't even know, some dumb investing thing. And then you throw like that one radical – and it's like, oh, yeah, we got all the voices in there. And I mean, it's just – honestly, like the solution circle to me is the biggest sham. Like just put out the report and let other people talk about the solutions because – I mean,
this is sort of why I think, and I'm sorry again, man, but this is why I think this is so important that it be discussed and looked at critically and why I started the way I started, because this is the same problem that I had with the way we discuss mass incarceration through Netflix and the 13th and stuff like that, is that these problems are presented with in part because everybody knows how jacked up things are. You know what I mean? Like poor people don't necessarily need another State of Black America report to know that their situation is messed up and that for the most part, they're not, or entirely, they're not the cause of it. So what has to be done is that the numbers have to be not only laid out in such a way, but framed by the people who are offered to discuss it so that nobody develops a too radical solution. And with all due respect to Opal Tometi and Black Lives Matter, one of the criticisms I've had of that formation has been that too often the solutions we hear popularly discussed, at least, go back to the same vote for a Democrat and, you know, basically vote for a Democrat and produce statement and position papers that don't have the requisite organization politically to make real. So I think that this is a good way of bringing someone in who's going to have something good to say about these issues, but isn't going to offer up solutions or encourage movements or patterns of behavior that would threaten too much the sponsors of this very work.
Mm. Well, and you know, part of it for me, and I don't necessarily even want to like say this is what they did, because I think the Urban League has been, you know, relatively supportive of things like comprehensive immigration reform, whatever the contradictions with that are, but you know, and especially in the executive summary, there was something that kind of rubbed me the wrong way about how they counterposed the sort of black-white disparities and then put right below it between the Latino and white people disparities, because in a lot of the areas it looks worse for black people, which is, I think, a whole other issue. But something about it is what, just because Trump's strategy is obviously, and it's been this through the whole campaign, and for whatever reason, no one wants to talk about this. But, you know, if you look at what he said about black people and compare it to what he said about Latino people and the way he's played it so far, he obviously wants to try to leverage black people against, you know, quote unquote foreigners and sort of expand this definition of Americanness to include the descendants of African American slaves and white people, at least rhetorically, if not in reality. And it almost seemed like kind of the way some of these numbers were counterposed was really kind of playing into that, like the unemployment ones particularly, kind of maybe playing into that like undercurrent of that kind of division that I think a lot of people are looking to push.
I think that's a fair point to raise. I don't know exactly what, you know, first, just to back up quickly to the point I think you were just making, I am certainly not meaning to blame Black Lives Matter, or Opal Tometi, or Marc Morial, or the Urban League, or anybody involved with this report for the problems. I am just wanting to make the point that there are certain forms of discussions about these issues that are encouraged by pockets of power over others. And in that way, I would argue that would be why we would have, you know, a Wells Fargo, Bank of America, AT&T sponsored or partnered report fashioned in this way or characterized in this way. I don't know, to the specific point of your last question, I don't know how else that they would be able to do this without making a specific point or stating it explicitly, that in the differences we may be showing between black and Latin American conditions vis-a-vis whites, that we're not trying to be allowed to be played off one another. And in fact, I would probably, obviously I can't speak for them, nor would they want me to, but I would imagine Morial's point would be that in his initial statement about defending the progress gained under Obama against Trump, that they are making it clear that the numbers that they're showing here and the differences between the various communities are not meant to be used to play one another, play, you know, each community against one another. But I do think that is something that has to be cautioned, because I do think there are tendencies in all communities to first look at that next so-called minority community as a comparative for good or for worse. And there are a lot of details and nuances, obviously, and experiences of both communities that would have to be considered before we could actually, you know, fully measure the or fully interpret the numbers as they're presented. But I mean, I hear your point. I just mm-hmm. don't know what else they could do right. other than to make the explicit statement. We're not trying to do that.
No, I hear you.
You know, so I will say, I mean, I will, and I want, I actually meant to ask you this, if we could flip roles here for a quick
Let's
moment.
Do it.
What do you think of their call for this Marshall Plan? We have, you know, and I, my entire adult life, I've heard versions of this offered as a progressive response to these conditions, saying that just like what was done for Europe after the Second World War, investment in black communities has to be offered, and it's offered up as sort of a progressive call. I wonder what you think of their updated version of that here in this report, because that's sort of the centerpiece of the report's, I guess, overarching solution to these problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the Main Street Marshall Plan, I think they call it. Yeah, I mean, it just,
right.
you know, a part of it, quite frankly, to me, it just – I hate to say it like this because, I mean, the thrust of it I get, but it just strikes me as sort of like warmed over rhetoric. You know what I mean? Like every sort of liberal social democratic solution to like any income inequality is, well, we need like a Marshall Plan. But I just feel like to some degree it's abstracted out of actually the way capital truly works. And it really is just a call for the government to spend a lot of money in these areas to try to like goose investment and then subsequently, you know, maybe lift people up. And I don't know, maybe it could. Maybe, I mean, if you start spending hundreds of billions of dollars, it's not going to do nothing. And I think they want like $4 trillion over 10 years, half of that in infrastructure. So, I mean, I can't say that it doesn't work, but I guess when you start talking about that amount of money, you're not actually talking about the reality of that amount of money. Like, you know, this is like a $7 trillion budget or whatever it is in the U.S. government. Like, where is this money going to come from? We're in the context of a Republican Congress. You're in the context of a fact where even Democrats are looking for lower taxes on corporations and supporting to some degree tax holidays and harmonization of tax codes in a globalized labor supply chain. Like, you can't really have this conversation about that level of capital if you aren't talking about significant nationalization of holders of capital, i.e. banks and other financial institutions, by which you could deploy said capital quickly enough, directly enough, and without enough strings to actually really make it directly affected in communities, because you have whole other issues. Like, if you want to do a lot of money on infrastructure and you don't have as many, you know, black construction workers, which is an area where we're traditionally underrepresented, and you want to make sure you have the employment effects of the people who are employing the infrastructure, that means you can't even start building right away. Because you got to train people. And then that takes, you know, some time. You just take a year or 2 years to get people this certain piece. And then there's just, I mean, there's just so many different issues that, like, it's so easy to say, and it's, like, such a thing to throw out there and to say, like, well, here we're going to spend $4 trillion and we're going to build this and do that and so on and so forth. But I don't think it really is, like, directly connected to how you would actually bring together that kind of those kind of resources in a way that really is going to make sense. So, I mean, that's my answer. We got about 30 seconds left here, so I don't know if you want to play off that.
So here we go. 30 seconds. I would need someone to inform me as to where investment of that kind erased poverty and inequality in any given society. And as we look at Europe now, even the Marshall Plan there didn't quite get that done. And the other thing I would say, just going back to where I started, I think we would end up seeing a situation where Bank of America and Wells Fargo are investing in communities by putting Walmarts and Toyota dealerships with AT&T carriers, allowing them to create a whole new environment in black America that would allow them to handle the investment, control the debt, and manage the ceiling.
Right.
Of whatever benefits would occur, and then we would all just be walking around with AT&T shirts and Bank of America hats and driving Toyotas and shopping at Walmart with Wells Fargo and Bank of America loans.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today's show. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but you were, as always, listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.